and welcome to Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. I'm your host, Andrew Heaton, now in Technicolor. So last week, I tried a release valve episode on Friday with comedian Jimmy Failla, where we assiduously avoided any topic which might even remotely qualify as useful or informative. Instead, we discussed funny headlines from the week. I thought it was a lot of fun, and apparently so did you guys based on the feedback that I've been getting. And I will resume doing a grab bag assortment of fun headlines next Friday. Not today, unfortunately, and that's because one of my personal heroes died this week, and I feel obligated to give the great man and great character his due. That man is Prince Leonard of Hutt River, a wily Australian who went from farmer to renegade royalty, the bane of the Australian government, and an unexpected tourist attraction in Western Australia. Quite the impressive character. I literally have a framed picture of him in my apartment. I've had that since college. And I think that you will enjoy the story of his exploits, and I believe it is certainly worth shoving around some funny headlines for a day to give him his due. If you've ever visited Hutt River, as I have, this will come as sad news to you that Prince Leonard has passed away. If you're unfamiliar with the Principality of Hutt River, then this is going to be a great story. And by the end of the program, you will have a new favorite tiny country and will probably give serious consideration to starting your own boutique nation. Now, I will add before we get into it, I'm not going to make this somber or depressing. Prince Leonard died at the ripe age of 93 this week, and though I am sure his family misses him terribly, I am going to celebrate him in the context that I think it should be, which is appreciating the feats that he pulled off while also being a lot of fun. And that's how I'm going to tell this story. So if anybody from the royal family is listening, no disrespect whatsoever. I believe the proper way for me to do this is to keep it fun. Now, that said, the show has to have a sponsor regardless, and so epitaphs or not, we do have to fund the program. And that means a word to this week's sponsor, Snuffies off Route 44. Snuffies is renowned throughout the Tri-County area, not just for its excellent food and 1/8 of a Michelin star, but for the celebrated fact that all of the waiters and waitresses at this diner take your order and serve it to you on horseback. This week, Snuffies offered a special deal for Something's Off listeners. If you called the Snuffies hotline and left a review of your recent dining experience, you might win a free dinner at your favorite equestrian diner. Now, the wait staff picked out which of these they liked best, and they played several for me to kind of give me an idea of what they sounded like. They were all fantastic and numerous. One gentleman called and left a very detailed description of his meal, as well as the contents of a postmodernist conversation he had with one of the waiters, probably Carl, about Derrida. In fact, I learned a bunch of new vocabulary words. It was very verbose and impressive. Several of you called in to say that Snuffies either saved or rekindled your marriage, which is heartwarming. And the waitstaff itself picked one in particular that is the winner and a free dinner, and we're going to play that for you now.
Hello, this is Isaac. I just got done eating it. Snuffies. It was fantastic. I had heard Heaton mention the corned beef hash, but it was fantastic. Excuse me, I'm definitely allergic to horses. One second. Can't be pinned real quick. Okay. But it was good. Corned beef hash, excellent. The horses were beautiful. I gotta go. Oh, God. The EpiPen isn't working. But if it does, I promise you, I will be back.
So congratulations to Isaac, the winner of a free dinner from Snuffies, for participating in that contest. He is currently in intensive care for a life-threatening horse allergy. Well, Snuffies is not only going to give you a gift certificate for a free dinner, Isaac, it's also going to send you a special order of deep-fried brisket to the hospital, care of Carlos, the therapy horse. That's right. Snuffies values its role in the community and supporting charities, and that's why Snuffies sponsors Carlos the Therapy Horse. Carlos visits hospitals, usually unannounced to both patients and administrators, to trot from room to room saying hello and passing out Jell-O. So Isaac, get better soon and keep your eyes peeled for Carlos the Therapy Horse. Snuffies off Route 44, because everything tastes better from a horse. All right. We're going to talk today about Prince Leonard. one of my favorite characters, as something of a role model in terms of life goals and eccentricity and pulling off things. And I'll tell you, the main reason that I like Prince Leonard is that he combined the plucky farmer who doesn't want to take crap from the government, that kind of impulse that I've got deep in my heart growing up in Oklahoma of don't mess with my farm, very much exemplified in Prince Leonard. But so is the kind of eccentric royalty thing that I like about Britain. They're kind of mingled in this man. And so before we start, what I want you to imagine is, I want you to imagine, if you're listening in America, which a lot of you are, I want you to imagine a farmer from Kansas. Now imagine that Kansas tries to screw him over, and he responds by seceding from Kansas, and he basically pulls it off. He basically does it and functionally runs his own country inside of Kansas. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. And in Prince Leonard's case, it's in Australia. Now, Leonard wasn't born Prince Leonard. He was born Leonard Casley in 1925. I don't recall what his father was, but it wasn't of anything of tremendous import. He was a working class guy of some sort. Leonard grew up in Western Australia, which is probably the closest thing to Oklahoma I've ever been to outside of the United States. In fact, I think Western Australia is more similar to Middle America than Canada is. It's basically Oklahoma with kangaroos and a beach. It's very, I felt quite at home there. So he grew up in that area, albeit before I did. When he was a kid, he would go to ships in a port in Western Australia, and he would sell wildflowers to people there until somebody asked him if he had a permit or not. And that shut that down, but kind of foreshadowed some looming battles that he would have with government again in the future. He left school at the age of 14, and then at the age of 18, he joined the Royal Australian Air Force and fought in World War II. So he was a World War II veteran. While he was in the war, he met his wife Shirley at a dance in Fremantle, and they, over the course of the next few years, had 11 kids between them. And the fecundity of the family has expanded fantastically since then. So there's quite a few great grandkids and grandkids. And I think about the time that most of his children had gone off to school or had become adults, about then he moved to an area of Australia called Hutt River in Western Australia, and he became a wheat farmer. So Hutt River, if you're unfamiliar with it, it's about 5 hours north of Perth, which is the city of note in Western Australia. Western Australia itself is very remote. It is Perth sort of hails itself as being the most remote capital in the world, because in order to get to it, if you're going to fly there, you've got to fly to probably Hong Kong or something, and then you go from there to Sydney, and then you take another plane flight from Sydney to Western Australia. It takes a while. And Western Australia itself is about the size of Alaska and Texas. And if you want to sort of visualize it, visualize Nebraska. So think dead flat, absolutely flat, lots of wheat and very amber colored, so kind of kind of brown, kind of dry, except that you do see the occasional kangaroo, and for whatever reason there's a ton of wild melons growing everywhere, so that when I went there it sort of looked like a truck full of softballs had exploded and just blasted these things all over the landscape. But think more or less Nebraska. That's kind of what this looks like. And I should add, of course, that most of Australia consists of absolutely nothing. This is not quite in the nothing category. This is still within the range of people growing farms and things. Most of Australia is absolutely nothing, and the remaining stuff is full of poisonous animals that want to kill you. Australia is amazing in that regard. I have never seen a duck-billed platypus. I don't think they exist, frankly. I think they're a hoax. But if they do exist, they are pervert beavers, in my opinion, because I don't think you should have a mammal that lays eggs. That's not right. So thanks, Australia, for that one. So anyway, it's about 5 hours north of Perth. The Hutt River region is 75 kilometers. So if you recognize Hutt River as its own country, as I do, then it is the sixth smallest country on the planet. It's considerably larger than Monaco. It's a little bit larger than San Marino being a small city-state that inexplicably never joined Italy. And it's smaller than Liechtenstein. It's between those two. And in 1970, he is a wheat farmer there, along with several neighbors, and the Western Australian government decides to impose a wheat quota on the entire state. Now, what that means is that the politicians in Perth said, we're going to stabilize wheat prices, which is to say that we're going to try and jack with supply and demand, and if we are able to restrict the amount of wheat that people produce, we can affect the prices that there are. Or to put this another way, we're not going to let you grow as much wheat as you want. We only want you to grow X amount because we're afraid if you grow too much wheat, it will lower the price of wheat. I'm going to refrain from going off on a free market tangent here. Suffice it to say, I don't think it's a good thing to try and artificially inflate the prices of food. I could see some unintended consequences there. But the more immediate consequences for people that were in it was that they were probably going to get into a lot of financial trouble. I'll add, I suspect that there might have been some tomfoolery involved in this, and that I've read some anecdotal accounts where some farmers were exempted from this, which tells me that this might have just been what frequently happens, where a regulation is designed to suppress competition rather than actually help anybody. But one of the people that was most certainly not helped by this was one Leonard Casley. So he is a farmer, as I said at the time, and the wheat quota would compel him to only be able to harvest 100 of the 10,000 acres he had. He's on a 10,000-acre farm. He could legally only harvest 100 acres of that. If you're not very good at math, 99% of his crop would not be available to him. I don't know a whole lot about the business side of wheat farmers, although I have several in my family. My guess is that if they were told that they could not grow 99% of their wheat, they would be in trouble. And that's exactly what Leonard Casley said. He said, if I'm only permitted by law to harvest 1% of my crop, I am going to go bankrupt. There is no way around that. So he sent a protest to the governor of Western Australia, Sir Douglas Kindrew, requesting a waiver. And Kindrew denied the waiver and did not give that to him. So after he had gone through kind of the normal channels of, you know, petitioning members of parliament to, you know, my business is going to go under because of this ridiculous law, he tried to sue Douglas Kindrew for $52 million on the grounds that the law was ultimately unlawful, but more importantly, going to ruin a bunch of people's livelihood. He thought that requesting or suing someone for that amount of money was basically going to draw attention to the underlying problem here, which is that the wheat quota was excessive and nasty. What ended up happening is that he got the ire of the government as a result of this. So rather than modifying the law of, like, maybe we're going to do a wheat quota of, you know, beyond 1,000 acres or however much, instead they just kind of came after him. So the Western Australian government at this point, a few weeks later, introduces a bill to parliament, which, had it been passed, would quote unquote resume his and other protesting farms under compulsory acquisition. So something similar to eminent domain, only just to punish you. So that was what he was up against. So Leonard's solution was to declare independence from Australia. That's what he decided to do. All right. I'm going to be ruined. My farm's going to be ruined. You're going to seize it because I refuse to go along with your ridiculous law. I'm just going to leave Australia. And he did, along with the other farmers in Hutt River. Now, at that point, I will say the other farmers in Hutt River were probably not numerous in population. I think that probably meant his family, maybe some of his sons that had other farms in the area. I think some neighbors and probably some hands. But nonetheless, that was the plan. And he did so under a few kind of loopholes that are there. I don't remember all of the intricacies of this, but he seemed to think that the Australian Constitution had not quite included Western Australia in the same way it had others. And he had some ground there. Is more information than you probably needed. Australia had originally thought it was going to have New Zealand as part of it. So they left a backdoor provision in it so that New Zealand can join Australia whenever it likes. New Zealand's never going to do this. And Western Australia, that I think was a territory longer than the other ones, was kind of brought in an odd capacity. So what he claimed was Western Australia wasn't incorporated the same way the other things are. Therefore, I have the ability to remove my chunk of it, and I'm going to do that. And he did. He declared independence. He, for the next year or two, grows however much wheat he wants. He just keeps growing wheat, and the Western Australian government doesn't really do a whole lot. But this does eventually get to the level of prime minister. So Western Australian government, probably thinking about jailing him, probably thinking about seizing his farm because they've told him that much. Eventually, this gets to the prime minister. Hey, some guy over in Western Australia is claiming that he's his own country and he's not abiding the wheat quota. And so they start sniffing around and they're going to potentially prosecute at this point, Leonard Casley and some of the other people that are working for him, some of the farmhands and things like that. So what he does in a very signature Prince Leonard move is he finds a loophole that's incredibly irritating to government officials to work with. He finds the Imperial Treasons Act of 1495. Now, this is an act that I think was still technically on the books in Australia, or I don't know how common law works in Australia. I think maybe if it goes back beyond a certain point, it just defaults on English common law. Anyway, that was what he was claiming. And the Imperial Treasons Act of 1495 said that any person providing assistance to a de facto prince in exercise of his functions as a de facto prince could not be accused of treason. The reason that this is here is that in English history, people are constantly going, you know what, you're not the real king, I'm the real king, I'm going to kill you. And if you prosecuted everyone that was in their employ, you'd kill everyone in the country every 30, 40 years, whenever there's a dynastic dispute. So the English at one point went, okay, we're not going to kill you if you're in the employ of a pretender. We'll just kill the pretender. That way they wouldn't liquidate the entire country every time there was a problem. So that's what Prince Leonard does, is he goes, all right, I'm a prince from now on, right? I'm a prince, and therefore you can't prosecute anybody that works for me because they're in the service of a prince. And that's how he becomes Prince Leonard. So at this point, he's seceded from Australia, become a prince to circumnavigate his folks from getting prosecuted. I will note he only is a prince, and he does that for two reasons. He doesn't want to secede from the British Commonwealth that he served during World War II and that he likes. And also, he likes Queen Elizabeth. He thinks she's a stellar lady. He doesn't want to give her the middle finger. So he picks a subordinate role within the royal hierarchy. That way, he's not interfering with the British monarchy. So at this point, Australia basically goes, all right, listen, you're not a country, you're not a prince, but if you shut up, we're going to quit bugging you about the wheat. And that's what happens. He keeps growing wheat. And basically, as I understand it, and I don't know the intricacies of this, but as I understand it, basically quits paying taxes for about 47 years. He gets into a correspondence with some government officials in Australia, and for a while the Australian Tax Office would send him a declaration saying that for tax purposes you are a non-citizen of Australia, i.e. he's inadvertently not keeping just the wheat farm, but also he's not being taxed on it anymore, so kudos to you there. So that goes on for a little bit. However, 4 years later, the Australian Post Office starts messing with Prince Leonard, and it refuses to deliver mail to Hutt River. They actually force the landlocked country to get their mail through Canada. So if you tried to mail something to Leonard, it would get sent to Toronto or something weird like that, which irritated Leonard. And he went back and forth on this. Didn't work. So his response, declare war on Australia. He declares war on Australia for about 72 hours. I've not confirmed this, but I've heard that he did it on like 4:30 on a Friday because he wanted the members of parliament to look at it and go, well, I don't want to deal with this till Monday. And then come back on Monday, there was already a note waiting on their desk that said something to the effect of, because you failed to deal with this within 72 hours, this is now a Commonwealth issue and not a national issue. I can't confirm that. That's what I've heard. What I can say is that there were two things that came out of declaring war in Australia. One, a lot of good press coverage, which I suspect was probably fairly positive because Australians like the underdog by nature. Australians were founded by the exact same people that populated the American South. We talk about Australia being a penal colony. So was the state of Georgia. And basically around the, you know, what would it be, the 1750s or 1740s, the English went, oh my, the felons that we keep sending to the New World are making a lot of noise and seem to have a lot of guns. Maybe we should send them somewhere else. So they sent them to Australia. So Australia has a lot of that kind of rural little guy fight the power type thing in it. So I suspect that worked out for him. But also, it was a legal maneuver that Leonard wanted to do for the benefit of Hutt River, and that was giving it international standing. So he writes a letter to the Governor General. He says, oh, I do trust you will enforce the laws of war. Sovereignty is automatic to a country undefeated in a state of war. Which is basically his plan there, is to declare war on Australia for 72 hours, not get Australia to mop the floor with them, but then to cease hostilities and then gain international recognition. Mixed bag there. You will notice that Hutt River does not have a UN ambassador, but well played nonetheless. So after that, there's kind of a Pax Hutt River for quite a few years, where Prince Leonard basically pulls it off and just gets to run his own country. And in fact, it goes fairly well. He's not got the wheat quota anymore. He's no longer paying taxes and begins to realize that there's sort of a side benefit to being prince of his own country, which is to say that he becomes a tourist attraction. And I do not gather that this was ever really an initial part of the plan, but it did become capitalized later on. So the capital of Hutt River is Nain, and people come and visit all the time. At its height, he was getting 60,000 tourists a year. It's gone below that to 30,000. I don't know what the annual amount is now. I don't think it's 30,000 anymore, but he was getting a decent stream of people that were coming through, which, again, I have to clarify, this is like being in Dropsy County, Wyoming. This is not a well-frequented part. Like, imagine if Giles County, Iowa, or Scrumpox, Idaho, suddenly had a county that seceded from the Union and was basically left to its own purposes, how that would kind of facilitate this tourist mecca. And that happened to Hutt River. So he's getting that going on. He's also enjoying being a prince. He's going in the yearly parade in the nearest city of Australia, Geraldton. He's got like a Rolls Royce or a Beamer or something. And it's got those, you know, those diplomatic flags you can put on the front of a car. He's got that with Hutt River. And he'd go in the parade every year with his wife, Princess Shirley. So he's enjoying that. He's printing his own money, which effectively a collector's item. I don't know how much internal business was paid for using Hutt River currency. You could do it because it was pegged and is pegged to the Australian dollar. So you're not getting external or internal inflation there. But also, like, I've purchased currency from Hutt River because I thought it was cool. So it's effectively an export. He's also making his own stamps, which turn into collector's items. He strikes a treaty with local Aborigines, and he becomes, this is one of his many titles, protector of the legends of the Nunda people. I don't know what that means, incidentally. I met Prince Leonard when I was in Australia, and I asked him about that, and he very kindly told me that he did not feel comfortable discussing it because the legends of the Nunda people were sacred to them, and he did not think it was appropriate to flaunt them to outsiders. So he seemed to have that for real in his internal portfolio. And I think he enjoyed being a prince, and I think he grokked the eccentricity of this, the novelty of this. He created armed forces for Hutt River, which population probably less than 70 people, if that, that live there. But nonetheless, there is a Hutt River Air Force. Not sure what the Hutt River Air Force constitutes. Could be a kite. Could be a guy with a plane. Wouldn't surprise me if there's a citizen somewhere in the rest of Australia that owns a biplane, and that might be the Hutt River Air Force. There's also an admiral of the Royal Hutt River Navy, and there's a Royal Hutt River Navy. It is a landlocked country. However, presumably there is a river in Hutt River, hence the name. So there might be some boats or canoes or something like that. However, nonetheless there. And there are a variety of royal titles. So to give you an example of this, I am friends with Steve Baikie, who is the aide-de-camp to Prince Leonard. And I refer to him as Sir Steve, but if I were to do the real formal way, I would address him as Lord Stephen Baikie, Knight Grand Commander of the Royal Order of Merit, Inspector General of the Diplomatic Security Corps, and Earl of Tankerness, if I wanted to get formal with him. However, as I said, I call him Sir Steve. Great guy. There is a Earl Marshal of the Royal College of Heraldry, David Burkhart, who I do not know personally, but I've corresponded with a little bit, and I can tell you he takes his job seriously. He's very thorough and very detailed in what constitutes official heraldry of the Principality of Hutt River. So all of that's going on. Everybody's having fun. And he's also getting overseas citizens, which I'll get to in a little bit, but I am an overseas citizen. Hutt River has two different categories of citizenship. It's got residents, and it's got overseas citizens, which is basically a way of saying I Andrew Heaton, could not go move there without getting into a lot of migration issues. So they wanted to, I think, establish that you didn't have a right to enter and remain in the continent of Australia without having Australian citizenship. So you can kind of see how that would bypass some issues. But there's overseas citizens. I've heard numbers as high as 14,000 people that are citizens of Hutt River. 10,000 is probably more accurate. I don't actually know the numbers. And they're getting like official sports teams and things. There was a local cycling team in Western Australia that was like, you know, the Royal Hutt River Peloton or something. I'm not sure what the name of it was. Maybe the Prince Leonard's. There was also a Welsh lady who competed in the World Bog Snorkeling Competition under the glorious flag of Hutt River. So there were a number of things that were going on. Fun times. However, in 2017, the government comes back, and it begins to ramp things up. So in 2017, prior to the government coming back, Prince Leonard abdicates. Nothing bad happens. He didn't get Me Too'd. He merely was getting older, 91 years old, still wily, still cunning, but getting tired. So he passed on the duties of the throne of Hutt River to his youngest son, Prince Graham, who became sovereign of Hutt River and remains so today. So no worries, the royal succession was already very smoothly established prior to Prince Leonard's death this week. And you will also be happy to know that he had, between him and Princess Shirley, something like 50 grandchildren and great-grandchildren. So the royal family is robust and will presumably go on for quite some time. So that happens in 2017, but shortly thereafter, the Australian tax office goes, "All right, wait a minute. Have you not been paying taxes since 1970? And they're none too pleased about that. So they give him a bill for, I think, about $3 million of unpaid taxes. I don't know why, but they only charged him for taxes between 2006 and 2013. I don't know the intricacies of that, but nonetheless, they do that. And Leonard takes them to court. Now, I think Leonard had paid some amount of taxes because I talked to him about it, and he told me that they paid paid what they believe was the correct amount, but they just labeled it internally as foreign aid to the nation of Australia. That way, you know, you're not paying taxes; you're just doing foreign aid that happens to compensate with the amount of taxes Australia would otherwise expect. But Australia's saying he didn't pay income tax, and they go after him. And Leonard basically has two arguments that he does with Prince Arthur, one of his other sons, to try and get out of this amount of taxes. The first argument is this: I do pay taxes. I pay them to Hutt River, the country in which I reside. That's the first argument. Australia doesn't have much business for that, or much time for that. They think that that's hogwash and nonsense. You can't declare yourself a sovereign prince of your own county or whatever. So they don't do that. The other argument, and I don't know how heavily they leaned on this in the court trial, but I talked to Prince Leonard about this when I visited him, I thought was fascinating. And it was basically this. Australia, starting in 1970, started depriving Leonard and his family of rights that they should have as Australians. They withdrew Social Security benefits. They withdrew pensions. They withdrew educational allowances and child endowments. His wife, Princess Shirley, couldn't get the medical benefits in Australia that she was entitled to as the spouse of a war veteran. So Leonard had an argument of, look, if I'm Australian, you either need to give me my rights. If you're going to take my mail and send it to Canada, you need to do that through the court system using proper rule of law and do everything as if I am a citizen of Australia who deserves the rights and privileges of Australia, or I'm not an Australian, in which case, leave me the hell alone. I happen to think that that's a pretty good legal argument, and I had kind of hoped that watching this unfold, Australia would ultimately go, right, yeah, okay, you know what, you are. And by the way, I think that that would be the smart play for Australia as well. Because this has been going on since 1970. This isn't some guy's backyard. It's 75 kilometers. And I think that it is of benefit to Western Australia economically. What I would do if I were Australia is I would go, okay, look, you're going to functionally be a free enterprise zone. So you can't have anybody move in to Hutt River that can't also qualify for citizenship in Australia. That way there's not some sort of, you know, Trojan horse of immigration issues. You can't have toxic waste and you can't murder anybody. But beyond that, do whatever you like. Because I know that there were several companies that wanted to register in Hutt River. And Prince Leonard wanted to make Hutt River a kind of Monaco or Switzerland inside of Western Australia. He wanted to make it this autonomous zone that could do some cool things. And I think they could. I think that would be the smart move for Australia. And I'll say, if I meet President Trump at some point, I think what I would tell him is, hey, if you really want to piss off Australia, I don't know why you would, but if you do at some point, recognize Hutt River as a real country, because that would have some really interesting implications, which I will. This brings me to me, by the way. I'm going to return to Leonard and the tax push from the Australian Tax Office in a moment, but because I do want to bring myself in, because I'm also one of my favorite subjects, I will. So I found out about Prince Leonard when I was in college. One of my friends visited. And he was in Western Australia, didn't know much about this, went out to Nain, the capital of Hutt River, went into the gift shop, and a smaller, older man went, right, I need to stamp your passport. And he went, okay, who are you? And he goes, oh, I'm Prince Leonard. So Prince Leonard was running the gift shop and passport control and the country simultaneously. I respect that in a sovereign prince. I respect getting into the work and actually doing what needs to be done, as opposed to living in a velvet castle, as the well-established saying goes. So that happened. I became a fan. I thought, for reasons that I've pretty well extolled, that this is great. This is there's a certain amount of kind of revolutionary zeal here combined with eccentricity and novelty and just a tad bit of the British. So I quite liked him, and I got into him. When I was a tour guide in Washington, D.C., I did that for a little while. I was a Segway tour guide. I kept a tip jar, and when I got tips on top of my salary, I'd put them in there, and I was debating between either buying a pistol called the Judge, which fires shotgun shells, or applying for citizenship of Hutt River. There is a small fee. I think it was $200 or $300. But I thought, you know what? I am deep enough into this that I want to be a part of this thing. So I ultimately went that route. I went Hutt River, applied for citizenship, got it. I'm an overseas citizen. And a few years later, I was in Australia. I was dating a young woman at the time who is from Western Australia, from Perth. And we decided to go up and visit Prince Leonard in Hutt River. And I did so in part because I just really wanted to meet the guy, but also because I had just got involved with Reason in any capacity, and they had commissioned me to write an article for him that became my first piece with Reason in Reason magazine called Prince of the Outback. So we went out and met him, and got along pretty well. And then at the end of the day where I'd interviewed and everything, Leonard went, "All right, I'd like to cut your jib. How'd you like to be my diplomat in New York?" And I went, "Oh, that would be great." So I became the honorary special envoy to New York. That's about the equivalent of a consul, except that in order to have a consulate, you have to have diplomatic recognition from the country you're in. Since the United States doesn't, for now, recognize Hutt River, I was merely honorary special envoy. However, if the United States should decide to recognize Hutt River because it's angry at Australia, I would become a consul and have diplomatic immunity, which would be awesome. Although I would have to check on that because I do believe, to be completely square and technical with you, I think that my diplomatic credentials have lapsed. The certificate I was given was for a limited amount of time. I believe that that time frame has ended. I am no longer an honorary special envoy by virtue of that alone. Also on top of that, I think I was Prince Leonard's personal envoy. So by virtue of him abdicating and then expiring, that would be no longer applicable. And then on top of that, I now live in Texas. So there's a little bit working against me, but I still feel like I'm part of the regime. So I'm going to, after an appropriate amount of time, reach out to Prince Graham and offer to give my services in whatever capacity that I can. I'll also say, having met Prince Leonard, I got the impression that he was a man who believed in what he was doing and believed in the legitimacy of the arguments he was espousing in terms of independence, but also had a real twinkle in his eye. I think he understood the implicit humor involved in the situation, and he enjoyed it. And I think that that's the way to approach the whole thing. It would have been a lot less fun if he was having no fun with it. And he clearly had a lot of fun with it. So that brings us back to the 2017 tax office flap, where the Australian tax office wanted to charge him for back taxes not paid. At this point, he's 91. He's teaming up with his son, Prince Arthur. And unfortunately, the Australian Tax Office did not see it his way. He was not granted recognition of independence from Australia, nor was he waived on paying taxes, and they charged him $3 million in taxes. Now, you might think at this point he'd go, right, fought the good fight, you know, been a long time, got away with not paying taxes for quite some time, but guess we got to give up now. So you might think that, but let's play a clip and see his reaction.
But with money now a little tight in Australia, the tax office has sent him a bill for $3 million.
I haven't got $3 million, so they won't get it.
They could take the principality.
No, they can't. We'll see.
I love that. Oh, I haven't got $3 million. Well, what if they take the farm? No, they won't. Yeah, they can try. They won't. Yeah, so he does that. I don't know what the tax status is now. I don't know whether they ended up paying it or whether they can pay it. I've had zero contact with them involving taxes. So in my capacity as a former diplomat, I cannot speak on behalf of the Principality of Hutt River regarding this highly contentious situation. I simply don't know. What I can tell you is that Prince Leonard, who died this week on Wednesday, led a very long, very full, highly colorful life that is worth celebrating and is in no way daunted by bureaucrats in the Australian tax office. He had seven kids. I said 11 earlier. That was incorrect. He had seven kids. He had 50 grandchildren, great-grandchildren between them. He grew up in Western Australia, fought in World War II, married the love of his life, and died a prince. But most importantly, that man, Prince Leonard, grew as much wheat as he damn well wanted. So hats off to you, Prince Leonard. I'm very glad that I got to meet you. Well done, sir. And to finish up this episode, rather than doing the usual rickety-rackety of announcements, listener feedback, and all of that, I think it is more fitting that we play the Hutt River National Anthem.
It's a hard land, but it's our own land, built with love and dedication. Selfish is our